I thought this would be a relatively low stress time to write a sermon. I mean, it's not low stress in terms of the world, but since I get to work from home, and where else am I going, I figure I could do it this week. But of course, I spent the week working on what turned out to be the largest grant application in my time at my current job. That turned my week into several long days and a few long nights. But Friday afternoon, I got to the point where I could hit submit. I put everything in, clicked the button, got the happy message that said, "Your application has been submitted. Please scroll down and look for it in the submitted tab." When I scroll down, it's not in the submitted tab. It's still in the in progress tab. I investigated for a while, and due to some glitch in the website, my digital signature could not be accepted. So my application was in that liminal space between submitted and in progress. So I tried help desk, and of course they were gone for the weekend. So now I'm left sitting in the anxious, powerless space. I have faith that my application was accepted, but I haven't seen the confirmation. So it's fitting today that I'm speaking about Thomas, the disciple who wanted to see before believing. Now, he's not my namesake. For one, I'm not a twin. You're welcome. But I often get the doubting Thomas, ha ha ha, jokes, especially because of my penchant for research, questioning, debate. So I'm inclined to defend him. The common understanding is that the other disciples had great faith and believed, but Thomas, he demanded proof. But remember, as John reminds us, he showed them his hands and his side before they rejoiced. They received the same evidence that Thomas demanded. In fact, all the post-resurrection appearances of Jesus showed the most faithful followers needed visual, physical confirmation of the miracle before believing. Mary Magdalene, the first to see him, thought he was the gardener. And when she realized it was actually him, I like to think she gave him such a huge hug and wouldn't let go, which is why he said, "Do not hold on to me." She told the disciples she saw him, and John doesn't even note their reaction, so I imagine there was still doubt. They didn't fully rejoice until they too saw him in the flesh, including the wounds. Now, Thomas's reaction wasn't a lack of faith, or at least a lack of the same faith that others had. It was a similar reaction to everyone else, maybe with a tinge of, "Why do I keep missing this? I want in." And a week later, this very second Sunday of Easter, he got the visual, physical proof everyone else got. This story of our need for physical evidence and comfort in times of trial takes on extra meaning today, literally 40 days from when I first learned what social distancing meant, and I had to change my work travel plans on the fly. It's our sixth Sunday of not meeting together in person. It's been 3.5 weeks since Indiana issued a stay-at-home order. Now that's in place at least through the month. Maybe a certain earthly power will call me Doubting Thomas on Twitter for this, but I won't believe the threat is over until I can touch someone. Not the typical joyous Easter tide we're used to, huh? How can I celebrate the resurrection when I can't even touch the wounds? But oddly, I feel more connected with the Easter story now than ever. Because while the resurrection was indeed a victory over the grave, the victory wasn't instantly experienced by all. Biblical accounts not only show that the reality of the resurrection came to people in waves, but it didn't immediately end fear and pain and sickness and even earthly death. Our full victory is to come, even if we're not sure when it'll come, how it will come, and what it'll look like. As I draw closer to the disciple whose name I share, I found others who have done the same. Tom Casey, an Irish Jesuit priest, rechristened him Thomas of the Wounds, and said his story taught him that not only could Jesus' wounds be transformed from painful ones to glorious signs of God's power, but the same could happen to our own. He says, quote, "That's reassuring. Even though I can continue to see my brokenness, I can be at peace. I can rejoice. In fact, my very woundedness makes me more like Jesus than having it all together would." Malcolm Guite, an English poet and Anglican priest, sees a common thread in Thomas's candidness throughout the Gospel of John with this ode. St. Thomas the Apostle. "We do not know. How can we know the way? Courageous master of the awkward question, you spoke the words the others dared not say and cut through their evasion and abstraction. Oh, doubting Thomas, father of my faith, you put your finger on the nub of things. We cannot love some disembodied wraith, but flesh and blood must be our king and kings. Your teaching is to touch, embrace, anoint, feel after him and find him in the flesh, because he loved your awkward counterpoint. The word has heard and granted you your wish. Oh, place my hands with yours. Help me, divine, the wounded God whose wounds are healing mine." Guite notes the importance of the risen Christ still having his wounds, not just faint scars, but actual holes in his flesh. Quote, "Whatever else is going on here in this mysterious death and resurrection of Jesus, it is not the case that all the sufferings and hurts that Jesus underwent were erased and overridden. That salvation is not about pretending that stuff isn't there or imagining it's never occurred or overriding it in any way. It's about redeeming it, transforming it, not forgetting it." Jason Storbakken, pastor of Manhattan Mennonite Fellowship, deep in the heart of the pandemic, gave such a powerful, prescient sermon on this text 1 year ago. Listening to it, complete with emergency sirens passing in the background, you'd think he was preaching today. He called the resurrected Christ's wounds a liminal space, quote, "an ambiguous and disorienting space that occurs in the middle stage of a rite of passage. It is the time between what was and what is to come." Doesn't that sound like where we are today? Some mourning victims of COVID-19, some nursing their own sickness, many feeling the economic strains, all of us sharing emotional, social, spiritual strains. We know where we are. We know where we're headed, or at least that we're headed to somewhere else. We just don't know where or when. Storbakken notes, throughout his ministry, Jesus spoke both in the present tense and in the future. He said, "Blessed are the poor. Blessed are the hungry." Storbakken goes on, and again, I swear he wrote this a year ago. Quote, "We are in this place right now where we probably feel more anxiety and fear and just questions of the unknowing. It's hard to embrace the blessing when there's so much uncertainty. Jesus calls us to this. Jesus' wounds touch our wounds. They heal us and make us whole." Now I recognize this all may be cold comfort to those of you who have experienced major loss in this time. I'm certainly not the one to tell you how to live through this in-between time of grief and pain and someday a promise of healing and wholeness. My prayer for you and yours is that God's constant presence amid your pain be made constantly known to you. But for those of us who have a more general sense of pain, loss, anxiety, and fear in this supposedly joyous Eastertide, I assure you, you are not alone. Your sense of doubt, of questioning, does not put you at odds with the Christian witness. It puts you right in the middle. For even though Jesus said, "Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have come to believe," He means people that have come later, in the decades before John wrote down his account, in the centuries since. Every person who looks to the risen Christ at Eastertide and says, "My Lord and my God," does so not because they have more faith than us, but because they too have been given evidence, the written and spoken testimony passed down, the lives and love of those who let themselves and their wounds be transformed by Jesus's wounds. A month ago, when this was really starting, I was reminded of Julian of Norwich's refrain, "All shall be well, and all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well." Jamie Lake shared a musical setting of it on the Goshen Sings Facebook group, and she shared it as part of our worship resources this week. And it's been kind of a mantra for me periodically through all this. And where I once would have found such sayings glib, along the lines of, "God is in control, and everything happens for a reason, and just have faith," it's much deeper than that. Fittingly, Norwich was, as one scholar recently noted, practicing self-isolation as a prayerful religious hermit in the wake of the Black Death pandemic. Her visions, which had become the foundation of her famous texts, were while she was on what was thought to be her deathbed. And it isn't her saying, "All shall be well," it's Jesus in a vision saying it repeatedly during a long debate with her, where she wonders, no, demands to know why God let sin and pain exist. Julian wrote, quote, "And thus in my folly, afore this time often, I wondered why by the great foreseeing wisdom of God, the beginning of sin was not letted. For then, methought, all should have been well. The stirring of mind was much to be forsaken, but nevertheless mourning and sorrow I made therefor, without reason and discretion. But Jesus, who in this vision informed me of all that is needful to me, answered by this word and said, it behooved that there should be sin. But all shall be well, and all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well." Neither Jesus nor Julian get into why sin has to exist. In my mind, it's Jesus telling us it's way too complicated for our earthly minds to understand. But since it is so, it's not the best thing for us to focus on. The best thing is for us to focus on that all shall be well, even if we don't know when, we don't know how, we don't know in what way, all shall be well. And Julian, known for her great love and kindness amid her mystical devotion, set one of countless examples of living lovingly, serving others, doing our best with what we know until all is revealed. So I sometimes repeat to myself, all shall be well. All shall be well. All manner of things shall be well. Because I've learned that repeating prayers and sacred words, even when I don't quite believe them, teaches me to believe them by practice. They become so familiar. They're almost physical bodies I can touch, can hug, can hold on to while the world rocks and sways. This Eastertide, I pray you can find words, music, Zoom meetings, time alone outside, to have the physical comfort you need until we can meet again. I promise you, I will give you the kind of hug I imagine Mary gave the risen Christ. And by then, maybe I'll even know if my grant application was submitted.